You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 115. Being a good writer is 3% talent and 97% not being distracted by the internet. Unknown.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Let me ask you a question. How do you get a kick-ass Sundance premiering feature film made? Now, I'm not talking about the sanitized version, but the blood, sweat, tears, and hustle that actually made it happen. The Make Cool Shit podcast documents the making of a certified fresh breakout comedy horror, Scare Me, starring College Humor icon Josh Rubin, The Boys' Aya Cash, and SNL's Chris Redd. This behind-the-scenes look is hosted by Aaron Hayafitz. Join him as he tears down the fourth wall of independent filmmaking. Check out the Make Cool Shit podcast on Spotify or wherever you enjoy your podcast. Well, guys, today on the show, we have Pamela Douglas. She is an award-winning writer and has written on shows like Star Trek The Next Generation and written an amazing book, now in its fourth edition, Writing the Television Drama Series. Now, I wanted to have Pam come on the show so we can do a deep dive into writing those Netflix-style, Hulu-style drama series, which are all the rage now and where many, many screenwriters are getting jobs. So we go deep into the weeds on writing the television drama. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Pamela Douglas. I'd like to welcome to the show Pamela Douglas. How you doing, Pam?
Hey, good to see you, Alex.
Thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
So I wanted to bring you on the show because you've written a book, you wrote a book, and this is the fourth edition of the book now, Writing the TV Drama Series. And obviously, the first edition is perfectly fine. Nothing has changed in television dramas at all. It's pretty much the same thing as Hill Street Blues, essentially, no? Things have definitely changed at a beatnik pace in television. Yes. And it's even, is it called television anymore? It's now streaming. It's like this whole thing. So we'll get into the details of it as we get through the conversation. But before we get started, how did you get into the business?
Well, I was always a writer. And by the way, I'm also a visual artist. So I have, nice. I have two lives. And it seemed to me long ago that the power in terms of communicating ideas, stories, characters, life experience, was all on television. I dabbled in movies, but nothing has the reach or the impact of television. Even in the era before streaming, because it's in people's homes, it speaks to them in an intimate person-to-person way. And that has sway over people's viewpoint and notions of what matters and who's in the world. So I think I was partly attracted to the scale.
The scale of what you could do. And I mean, yeah. When you were writing, I mean, you worked with, you written for Star Trek The Next Generation, which was an amazing show. And a lot of shows in the 80s and 90s. I mean, for the youngins listening, back then it was three channels and there was only so many shows you can watch, where now there is just, an obscene amount of content coming through the doors all the time. How do you, as a writer, obviously there's more opportunity now than ever before to be a television writer, but how do you break through as a series? How do you try to get in? I mean, both as a writer and as a series creator, and I know those are two very different
doorways. They're not different. No, okay. Actually, they're a single track and just one's ahead of the other. Let me address the first point. It's true that most of my credits are from the later 90s into even early 2000. Next Generation, bless its heart, was a very long time ago.
Yes, it was. And I don't know how that's possible since you look like you're 25, so I really don't.
Thank you so much, my dear. But it was an important show at its time, and it's the one that people cite because it's familiar. Most of my writing after that really was in originals, the TV dramas, TV, what was it at one time called TV movies. Mm-hmm. So I've done a large spectrum of things in television even before I started teaching it. But what has happened in terms of evolvement is that, when I was a beginner, there were three networks, then four, which are now the legacy networks, the traditional networks. They're still around, but even they are going to streaming. You mentioned something about, whatever television is, if it's even a word anymore. And I think there's a simple answer to that, which is that television is inclusive in the language. In other words, television long since stopped being a box in the living room. Right. People gathered. Most people watch television on their computers or on other kinds of screens now. The difference, in fact, between small screen indie films and large screen televisions is almost disappeared. And as Netflix in particular, and HBO always has, also Amazon to another extent, have moved into the two-hour format, what used to be called feature films, that blurs the line even further. So the question is, of what is television, is an interesting one. The Writers Guild has a definition, and it's a strange definition because it says television is everything that is not feature films in a closed movie house. And that is
immense.
Yeah. Well, because the problem with that, not problem, but what that opens up to is to what extent are games television? They are looked at on a screen, so we're off on that side. And then when you get to the whole international aspect of all of this, the definition of the range of television gets even more expansive, where television is made, how it's made, who it's made for. All of this is new, and I think it's encouraging, really, to people who are coming into the industry. Because you mentioned, is it different to create a show or to write for a show? Well, the way in, which is the question you actually asked before I vamped on it, the way in is twofold. The first thing is that it's basically a ladder. That the way into doing anything, including creating original series, generally starts with whatever is the lowest rung on a series ramp. That's usually staff writer, but sometimes it's writer's assistant, which is a fine job. Sometimes it's researcher. There are people who have taken any job they could get, including secretary, just to get their foot there. And once they're there and you meet people, they might be embarrassed to not read your script. So that's the hope, that you get in somewhere. Once you do that, if you're successful in your first forays as a writer of an episode for somebody else's show, you will find yourself moving up and up and up and up until somebody offers you an overall deal or says, hey, do you have an idea for a show you'd like to do? Because I see now you're a good writer. And that's normal. That's normal. It's not the only way. There are people who have, with the tremendous amount of production, just immense amount of production, who have written pilots. I have had a number of students who have written pilots and sometimes been successful in actually placing them. They don't get to be the showrunner if they're a new writer, because they wouldn't know how to run the manufacturing operation. But they do, if they're smart, they stay with the show and come on in a mid-range and can grow with the show. So, yeah, I have seen it happen. Once in a while, not often, but once in a while, I've often known of people who've written theatrical features that became backdoor pilots. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you got to a pilot not by writing a pilot that you admit that is a pilot, but by writing something that shows your voice and your characters and your world and gets someone excited to go into further development.
So is that a backdoor pilot? I was going to ask you what a backdoor pilot is. It's like me writing a script and then sending it in. And they're like, really, it's really a pilot for a show. It could be turned into a show, but you're disguising it as a feature script?
Kind of. Basically, it's something, it's not unusual to have a two-hour pilot anyway. These days, a lot of readers, judges, agents, managers, producers don't want to read 100 or 120 pages because you can tell in 60 pages or less whether there's a voice, whether there's a personality, whether there's whether this is a real storyteller. Mm-hmm. So they figure they can know it from that. If you marry that with a Bible, it goes on to the answer to the question of why is this a series and not a movie? In other words, how come it doesn't just end right there? Where are the legs? Where are the springboards? And where are we going to be a few years out? Now, you hear of everything, though. I mean, if you look at something like Netflix that's been on a mad buying spree all over the world, you know, that's the Netflix joke. Somebody comes in and the pitch is, I want a story about who? And they said, yes, I love it. Here's some money.
Exactly. Well, like it's a perfect example. Like, you know, Jaws can't be turned into a series. Like that's a pretty much beginning, middle, and end. Jaws, the series, is going to be very difficult to pull off four seasons of that.
You know what? No. I wouldn't personally propose Jaws the series. Somebody who is clever enough who can't Jaws the movie and do what theatrical features often do. Look at all the Batmans.
Yeah. Well, but
at all the Star Wars.
But those are adventures that could happen where it's just basically Jaws is the one. You can maybe stretch it out over to like a season, but I can't see 5-6 seasons of.
It would have to change.
Yeah, it'd have to be a new thing. It'd have to be a whole new thing.
Actually, this is a question I'm sometimes asked from somebody who writes a finite script. And it ends, possibly because the character dies at the end, so you can't go on anyway. Or the quest is finished. The arc is finished. And they say, gee, I'd love to do this as a series. And I don't know how, because it finished. And my answer to that is stop looking at the ending. Look at the middle. You don't expand from the end. The difference between writing episodic television and movies is partly that a feature film script or a finite script has an arc. Somebody wants something. Here are the conflicts and the complications. They go through all the obstacles, and at the end, they win it or lose it. Television can still have that kind of horizontal storytelling, but it also has vertical storytelling. And what I mean by that is that while you will do your plot in a horizontal way, has to be so much depth in the characters that you could take a character from the center and tell stories outwards from that. So it's not then the question of what happens to Jaws the shark, or in fact, any of those characters. Mm-hmm. It may be the story of one of the people in it who's affected and how their storyline goes. I'll give you a perfect example, a classic, great example, is what happened Breaking Bad.
You read my mind. You read my mind.
Brilliant, brilliant. Now, it's Vince Gilligan, who is a great writer and expert in this whole thing. Walter White is dead at the end of Breaking Bad. Show is vastly popular. Where are you going to go? And they brilliantly went to the lawyer, Saul Goodman, and did a prequel, which is absolutely a wonderful piece. Very often a spinoff of any kind is not, you know, they're just trading on it. This is brilliant. It stands on its own feet as its own show with its own style, its own tone, its own cast. And that's a perfect example of expanding up from the middle, from one of the characters and the richness, rather than going from the end.
Right. And that, and also with Saul, is at first you're just like looking for the Easter eggs from Breaking Bad. But after a while, you're just watching it because it's a good show, not just like, oh, there's that thing from that episode of Breaking Bad, or oh, there's that one character is back. And
that's
all great. But at a certain point, wow, it's just Saul. Now it's just like its own thing. And it took them a little bit to find those legs, but they found it.
Yeah, but they had character richness to start from. It's him, also the character of Mike. There's a whole episode called 5-0. It's in the first season. I think it's the third episode or something, where Mike, I forgot his last name, you know who I mean.
Yeah, Mike. Yeah, of course, Mike. Yeah. Mike, I know who you're talking about, yes.
Yeah. Where it's his life with his grandchild and his background and all that. You can do that if your characters are rich enough. You can't do that if all you've got is a plot. I mean, if all you've got is a scary shark, not that that's all Jaws had, but if that's all you've got, you really don't have anywhere to go. But great television, you can spin off vertically as long as characters have secrets.
Right. And or people are interested, like, I'm like, what was Saul like before Breaking Bad? You're like, wow, like, he's such a great character. He's a runaway in a show with 1,000 great characters. He was he stole the scene anytime he was in it. I mean, literally.
Yeah. Oh, well, that, and also it posed questions like, how did this attorney get into this situation?
Right. What got him into the strip mall? How did he get into the strip mall?
All of it. Yeah. You know? And so what you want a pilot to do is not answer questions, but to ask them.
Right. Exactly. Now, one thing you said earlier, which I wanted to really emphasize this to the listeners, because there's a lot of writers out there who really don't understand the machine that is television writing and television creation. You said the manufacturing process, and I've never heard television used in that, but it is so apropos because it's exactly, it's in our industry, the closest thing we have to a product, because our industry is insane. I mean, the entertainment business is, it's pretty crazy, because we create a product, and then if the product's a hit, we can't create it again. So if we have one big hit, that's why there's sequels and prequels, and they're trying to you know, when Star Wars a hit, they're like, we need the sequel to Star Wars. But television is the like, but if you have a bottle of Coca-Cola, you can make 1,000,000,000 Coca-Cola cans and keep making money, but you can't do that with entertainment. But television is the closest thing we have to that, where you can recreate that product. And it's a manufacturing. Is that fair?
I would depart from the analogy to Coca-Cola, because...
Because
every episode, if you again look at something great like Breaking Bad, any of the great shows, each one is a work of art in and of itself.
Correct.
However, you are right, and what I meant by the manufacturing process was actually the act of what it takes from your first idea to things getting on television, or things getting on any screen. With a movie, there's also a manufacturing process. There are people who do the camera and the sound and the editing.
Sure.
So you are still manufacturing a product. With television, especially traditional television, you really had to spill out a product every week.
Right.
Which means that you have to have a writing staff. You have to have a structure with a showrunner, with executive layers, and with people who have jobs that you can depend on to deliver. There are many stories before streaming, which is structured a little differently, of what happened when the script falls out. When it's, you think you've got it, you've got a tight schedule, you have to shoot for 7 days, you have to edit this number of days, you have these days before it actually airs and it's already advertised. And the thing falls out and you end up with a repeat episode. It rarely happens, doesn't happen really anymore. But it's a marathon. If you look at something like The Good Wife, which was probably the last of the great written series that tried to do 24 episodes a year, my God, which nobody does that anymore. Nobody does that anymore. And they did it well. They did wonderfully. It's been compared to Ginger Rogers, who has to dance as well as Fred Astaire, but backwards in heels. That's what happens with trying to do something like The Good Wife with all those episodes. Nobody does that anymore. Series are now, maybe Netflix might do 13. The number of episodes in a season has pretty much settled in at 8 to 10, mm-hmm. 8 to 11. So there are shorter seasons, and because with streaming especially, they're all in the can in advance, or almost all in the can in advance, that intense weekly pressure to get that script done and out there is not what it used to be. And that it also makes other changes happen. But what I'm talking about with the manufacturing is when I see somebody who has a pilot and a good idea, but is a beginner, has really not worked on a show, or even if they've worked on the show a little bit, far be it from them to have a clue about the budget or the set construction or casting, a million other things. And that's where, and they say, I'm going to be the showrunner. It's my show I create. Well, no, you're not. and you don't want to, because you don't know what to do with the various craft unions. You really don't know what to do in terms of directors, actors, even staffing your show. So that's why it takes some time actually being in the business to move up to that. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with learning your craft. I must say, that's how I learned everything. I mean, now I'm a professor at USC, so my students all come out of school, you know, with some education in all of this and experience, and they have a portfolio. When I was starting, I really hadn't gone to school for it. I'd been a creative writer, done other things, but I learned because the showrunners took the time on a staff to say, you know, no, there are not three acts in television.
Right.
No. Or even this is how a page looks.
Basic stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, what are some myths about writing television dramas that you would like to debunk here?
Excuse me. The book has a chapter on some of my favorite terrible myths. I'm going to open the book to the myths. Let's see. Where are my favorite myths? By the way, book, everybody. Everything you would ever want to know is in this book. Where are the myths? Okay. All right. It is. Okay, here we go. It is in the very first chapter. And the first myth is that TV is small movies. TV is not small movies. TV is very, 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 very big movies. Because if you've got something that's going to end in 90 minutes or 2 hours, you're off the hook pretty quick. If you've got something that's going to go on for 100 hours, as some do, or even 36 hours, with the three series of 13, or even if you've got a limited series of something that's going to be 6 or 8 hours altogether, it's much larger. Also, even the size of the screen sizes are changing. Yes, people are watching. People watch everything on phones. It drives me crazy. Somebody has taken the trouble to beautifully light and go move through
color
the
color and everything. Yeah.
The size. But no, TV is not small movies. Here's another one. TV is cheap. Well, it depends.
Yeah.
There is some cheap television. YouTube is cheap. Mm-hmm. There are some off network platforms, especially those for very young audience that pay lower salaries and don't have much budget. But in general, you look at HBO, Game of Thrones, please, you're telling me that's cheaper than some feature films? No, it's much more expensive. There's more of it. There are cost savings in various areas because you may have sets that you can reuse over time, so you, amortize some costs. But no, unless you're getting a movie budget that's completely bloated because of a star salary or something like that, movies, even very expensive ones, are not more expensive than television, and television costs plenty. So I wouldn't even think about that. Now, I do warn students to be realistic that if you're going to decide to create your own series, you're a beginner, you know, use common sense. I mean, if you're going to have people flying all over the world for, you know, international locations and you're a beginner, the answer is going to be no. If you're Game of Thrones, the answer is yes, but you're not Game of Thrones. So common sense.
Now, what you in your book, you talked about a presentation reel. Can you explain what a presentation reel is?
Yeah.
And why writers need to do it if they do?
No, I don't do it.
Okay. So what is it? So we avoid it.
I'll tell you what it is, and then I don't think it's worth the time.
Okay.
I'm advising you not to do it with the caution that there is nothing that you can't do sometimes and won't work sometimes somewhere.
Sure.
So there's nothing hard about this. But a presentation reel is basically clips from other work you've done, or it might be scenes from what you're hoping to do that you are going to present to a network or studio as an example of your plans. That's really not the way things work anymore. Generally, it's pretty straightforward in terms of brand new shows. They want to see your pilot script. The pilot script accompanied by a Bible. Now, there's a story from long ago, and this story I don't think happens anymore, but this was way back in my beginning baby days. There was a movie called Starman.
Mm-hmm. That was the John Carpenter.
It was a movie.
Yeah.
And because it was a successful movie, for some reason, Michael Douglas, the actor, for some reason, I have no idea what his connection to that movie was. Maybe he had an ownership in it. I don't know. But he decided this should be a television series. Well, there was really no way for that to be a television series. That was a classic case of something that actually pretty much ended. And it was at a time before streaming, serialization was different. It wasn't a good idea. But because he is an important person, he decided that the way he was going to present this, with no pilot, with no nothing, was to get some of his friends, who were also professional actors, to ballpark some scenes that might be in the future. So this guy goes to top brass at the network, because he's who he is, and says, here's some clips from how this is going to show if I take this franchise and make it into a series. And because he is who he is, they said, okay, green light that. Green light what? There was nothing there. And he wasn't interested in staying with the project. He had other jobs to do. None of the people in those clips were in the show. And they left with a commitment for a show on the air. I think this was like spring and it had to be on the air in September or something with Zip.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So they brought in some very, very experienced producers, television producers who had just done a lot of work. And they put out a call to the agencies. Please send us some writers who can tell us how to do the show. And I was one of the people brought in, which is how I came to know about this. they gave us a Bible, which was mainly their hopes for who would be in it and how it would work, but no stories because they didn't know. It didn't last. I think they did get something on the air. I wasn't part of it, so I don't know the rest of the story.
Right.
That story doesn't happen anymore. Really, I wouldn't bother making a presentation reel for anything. I would just write well. Now, there are cases where people have done web series that are in effect presentation reels.
Right.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
You're showing something on screen that gives the look and feel of it. But it's not the way it mostly works. Honestly, the way most shows get on television right now is that they have underlying books.
Or so, IP of some sort.
Of some sort. It could be a graphic novel, good
right.
example, or another movie. It could be a play. Mm-hmm. But mostly novels. And so sometimes people who are struggling to get into the business because they have a deep sense of story and character and really something to tell. And if they don't have an MFA in screenwriting and are not in one of the fellowship programs, they might actually be better off doing a graphic novel or a novel and taking that in to see if they can adapt that. The reason that is so attractive is that it gives a buyer the sense that the project has a future. You see, because one of the questions you ask in television is, besides, is this well written? Do I like the characters? Is the story moving? And all those things. They're asking, is there enough here for many, many episodes? And a novel will answer that. Again, back to the Lord of the Rings, and,
right.
you know, or other great examples like that.
So and then how the hell did Vince Gilligan ever get Breaking Bad made? Because that's arguably one of the worst pitches. He even said, he's like, this is the worst pitch ever.
Yeah. Well, Vince Gilligan didn't come out of the woods. Gilligan
yeah.
already had a track record.
Yeah, of course.
And he wrote the script. He wrote the original
pilot.
Script. Yeah. The script for the pilot was not awfully different. The names changed, the location changed. But it was not awfully different from what was finally shot. If you look at the original script, that show benefited from an oddity, which is a writer's strike at the time.
Yeah.
Because they had time to do development that he hadn't done in advance. They were going to kill off Jesse.
Yeah.
And fortunately, the show got suspended during the strike, during which time they said, oh, wait a minute, that is the show.
Right, yeah, because that's exactly it. Yeah, because it was only eight episodes, I think, of the first season or something like that. It was a short run, and then they picked up afterwards. Yeah, I've studied that show. It's one of my favorite shows of all time.
Oh, it's great.
There's basically, I think, two episodes that I wanted to kill somebody afterwards. But other than that, every other episode, the fly episode.
The fly
episode. Please stop. I mean, I was watching The Fly.
Tour de force.
I don't know what that was, but I'm just sitting there going, why are we, what is going on? Like it could.
Mostly only two characters in the whole hour. A little bit of something else, but not much.
No. And there was a fly. There was a fly and two characters.
Genius, because it was a metaphor. It wasn't a fly. I mean,
I know. But like.
Brilliant. Yeah. There are some other examples of things that once were what was called miniseries, which is a word you don't really hear anymore, like Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
Which started as a very tiny group of shows was so popular that it took off and ran for 5 years. But it was another case where Ron Moore, a great showrunner, an experienced writer, who, by the way, had his training on Star Trek, knew how to draw out stories that come from character going forward, because it did have legs.
Yeah. And I think they're talking now about, Queen's Gambit was one of the limited mini, not a miniseries, but it's a limited series on Netflix, which was, it just exploded. And who knew? It's, a show about chess, and it's brilliant. And it's so popular that they're actually talking about doing another season of it. And I'm like, it ended. Like, how?
I saw it. I thought it was successful. I really don't know where it's going to go from there.
I mean,
but in the right hands, who knows? Maybe they'll develop one of the other characters in the depth. I forgot his name, the boyfriend.
Yeah, or her as older. I don't know. Like, I don't really like. Is she going to become the Mrs. Miyagi and teach somebody else? Like, I don't know where you go with it. But it was so well done. It was so well.
But those are the kinds of puzzles that are given to writers coming in who are new, and they. Right. Somebody says, look, I've got a quandary. I've got this product here. I don't know what to do with it. And then they hear pitches and somebody comes up with a way to do it.
You, in your book, you also spoke about the 4-act grid. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. Again, people really need to see the book. Not because I get 10 cents for it, but because it's got...
You get 10 cents. You're good. Most only get 5.
No, because it really goes into depth in this. The 4-act structure goes back to traditional television, where an act occurred, the act breaks occurred because commercials had to be fit in. Roughly every 13 minutes or so, 13 to 15 minutes. And you take the hour and you divide it, and that's what you get. The template became teaser plus 4. And then after that, sometimes teaser plus 5. It was originally created partly because of commercial television, which doesn't make sense anymore on any of the streaming places. Mm-hmm. And we're setting aside Hulu that just interrupts things bizarrely, but that's their problem. Mm-hmm. You can buy it without the commercials.
I do. I don't have
which commercials. I couldn't stand.
And Peacock too. I did with Peacock. I just got Peacock to watch Yellowstone, and I'm like, what is? How much is it a month? I just need to. I can't do the commercials. This is ridiculous.
No, exactly. So that's how the structure emerged. But if you really look at it structurally without being concerned about the commercial breaks, you discover that things that don't have commercials anymore are still largely relying on something like that in order to have some sort of basis for telling your story. And if you think about it, the so-called 3-act structure, the old Sid Field model, is the first act is 1/4, the second act is half, and the third act is 1/4. But if you do a midpoint in the middle of that second half, which you need anyway to turn it, you've got a 4-act structure. So it's kind of a normal breathing structure. So I recommend that to students and people who are just struggling with laying out this plot at an early time. It gets more complicated when you have A, B, and C stories. When you have parallel storytelling and it's not a single story that's broken up that way, but you might have this many beats of the B story in this act and this many in another act, and it's not quite as linear. And then you come over to something like Netflix and HBO, and they don't want to hear about that. They want to hear you break the story based on character arcs. But the truth is, even if you break the story on character arcs, the writer has to go home and organize the scenes somehow. And that's why I recommend that writers try filling in the grid just to get an overview of the layout of the story. You can be flexible with it to some degree, there are some template things that tend to work. For example, Act One is usually longest. In a classic script, it might end somewhere around page 18 to 20. Act Four is shortest, or if you've got a five act, Act Five is very short. It's almost a tag. So there are ways to make adjustments, but you need something to hang on to, and that's why I put a grid in the book just before you're even writing, just so you can see it laid out. In effect, you're talking about chess, sort of like a chessboard, where all the moves are going to be and where the things are going to be and where you can move stuff around in the earliest stage before you start writing.
Now, when you talk about A, B, and C kind of stories, when you're structuring a four-act or a grid, let's say a four-act grid or four-act structure, with these parallel stories, how do you allot the time in, let's say, the first act, establishing the characters? If you have ABC characters, and say, well, let's talk about the pilot, because once the show is off and running, it's a different conversation. But let's say the pilot. How do you adjust the, or allocate time to these other plot points in the structure in general?
Mm-hmm. Usually, the A story is the dominant character of the series, or certainly the dominant character of this episode. For a pilot, it's probably the dominant character of the whole series. And you will probably want to tell that story throughout first. So if you have, let's say a scene is roughly 2 minutes, that's not always true. There was a time when there was a lot of vignette storytelling and people were pushing the scenes to be one page long. There was also a kickback on that and something like Mad Men, which is very slow, where you would have really, really long scenes, which by long, I only really mean 3 or 4 minutes.
Right.
I mean, we're not back to Casablanca with the 7-minute scene because people won't sit for it. That is, the audience is ahead of you now. Mm-hmm. But let's just use as a ballpark number. Let's say a scene is in 2 minutes. And let's say you've got 60 minutes, which nobody's got 60 minutes. But let's just imagine that. 2 minutes into 60 is 30 scenes. You're not going to get 30 scenes. Let's go for 28. And then you say, okay, so the whole hour is going to be something like 25 to 28 scenes. That's all you got. And people sometimes mistake it, and they're up in 50, 60 scenes, and they're doing, you know, some large movie, and no, it's shorter than that. So let's say if you were to have four acts divided into 28 scenes, that would give you roughly 7 scenes per act. It doesn't actually work out that way. Act one is a little longer and four is less, as I said. But what you would want to look at is, okay, out of these 28 scenes, you're probably going to have many of them be your A story. Is it going to be 12, 14? You know, maybe it's 14, maybe it's half of the whole show. Well, now you've only got 14 scenes left over to divide between B and C stories. Probably your B story is going to be pretty important also. And so you might have 10 scenes on the B. So now you're up to 24. That leaves you only 4 scenes for the C story, which is fine because the C story is sometimes a runner. Those are ballpark numbers. Nobody should try to do that exactly. I'm just giving a sense of the rhythm. There are many shows with the A and the B story, meaning the story for one character and the story for another character, are almost balanced, are almost the same size. There are also shows when the pilot in particular will not have A, B, and C stories, will really follow the central main character who's got a quest throughout the show, and that is where you are going with your storytelling. That's what you want to hook the people on. So you may have only an A story show, and that's okay.
Which is fine. I mean, I'd argue like something like Sherlock that was done over at the BBC. Sherlock is obviously the main driving force, and that's also procedural. But Holmes gets a little bit of action every once in a while, but generally what drives the show is Sherlock. And that happens with all, you know, you could go down the line with all these kind of major shows. But yeah, I was just curious on how you felt to kind of like, we're really starting to break it down into the nuts and bolts of an episode and of story and things like that. And obviously we could talk for hundreds of hours about this, but this is just a touch. That's why you want to go out and buy the book. Now, you did talk at something, you referred to something called the staff ladder. Can you break down what the staff ladder is like in general, and so people get an understanding of what the pecking order, if you will?
Yeah. Well, the lowest level, there used to be a job on a lot of shows called staff writer. A lot of shows don't do that anymore, and that entry level is now very often the writer's assistant. It's actually not technically a writing job, but it's a way into a writing job, and it's a good job. You get to be in the room where the stories are broken. You get to see all the scripts. It's a wonderful postgraduate learning experience. Then the first step after that is staff writer. Staff writer may or may not get to write an episode. They might just talk in the room, or they may get assigned one or two. The problem with the staff, not the problem, the situation with that beginning level is that you've got your salary, but you may not be paid in addition for the script. So it's a financial difference.
Right.
The next step up from that is story editor and then executive story editor. In some shows, a story editor is a high-level position. In other shows, it really just means a staff writer in their second year. Shows don't use these titles always in exactly the same way. So the story editor is going to probably be assigned one or two scripts. They will be paid for the script in addition to their weekly salary. And they may have some little bit of rewriting jobs. They're also continuing to learn. Again, it depends on your show. Sometimes it's higher level. After that, the next step up is producer. Producer in this sense does not mean producer like you think of a movie producer. It's a writing title. And it's simply one more step up. You're getting a larger salary. You're getting paid for your script. You may be rewriting scripts from the lower level staff people and somebody a little more experienced. After that, you're supervising producer. All these are promotions. If a show goes on for a while, you may get promoted up the ranks, or you may go to another show and make a lateral move, or you might be hired up. Depends how good your writing is and other things. Supervising producer very likely is doing rewriting of other people's scripts or holding the hand of the beginners. Sometimes it's a complete rewrite that gets put on in the supervising producer's lap in addition to writing their own scripts. From producer on up, you're also probably sitting in on casting sessions and you're going to dailies. So you're seeing actually the process of it. You're seeing how it changes and you're learning your show. You're learning the strengths of the actors. You're learning all of this. From supervising producer, next level up is executive producer. It's a very wiggly title. There are some shows where everybody on the show is called executive producers. It's meaningless. It just means that their agents got them a bump up and they're just still writing and rewriting. But on some shows, the executive producer, many shows, is also the showrunner.
Right.
And the showrunner is the person whose vision is guiding this whole, as I said, manufacturing operation, but is also the visionary and has the look, tone, feel, style. And in some shows, depending on who's doing it, some executive producers and showrunners will run every single script through their computer, even if it doesn't need changes, because they want to feel ownership of it or they want their own voice in it. So all scripts in that sense are written by those people. David Kelly is an example of somebody who runs a shop like that. Generally they do let the lower level writers keep credit on screen, but actually it's a very much rewritten script.
Interesting. Yeah. And so basically the buck stops at the executive producer / showrunner.
The showrunner.
Yeah.
You might have five executive producers.
Yeah. So, but the showrunner is the guy. And like you said, it's just such a different skill set than just being a writer. And a lot of writers are like, I wrote the pilot, I'm going to be the showrunner. I'm like, you have no idea what. And experience. And you could be an experienced writer with a lot of credits and still not have the skill set or the personality to be a showrunner.
Well, you know, it is a matter of personality. This is an executive job.
Right.
Not everyone wants to be an executive. Some people want to, you know, have more of their own time to really create. It depends what you want to do. There are, if you think of a great showrunner, is John Wells, one of the masterful showrunners. John Wells is essentially a manager. When he graduated from USC, he had written some, and his first jobs were as a writer, but he graduated from the Peter Stark program, which is producing business program. And that was always why he did such a wonderful job on whether it was West Wing or ER or more lately Shameless and, you know, all his other credits. He's got a million credits. Because he was an outstanding manager, he is not just what he could write, but that what he could enable other people to write, which is what makes a great manager.
Right, exactly. And I just wanted to make sure everyone listening, if they have any illusions of writing their first pilot and then show running, it's a really different skill set. That's why a lot of writers who jumped into the director's chair get a stark reality, and vice versa when a director wants to start writing. It's just a different skill set. And some people are that wonderful combination, like a Vince Gilligan, who can just bring it all together.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
But it's hard. That's why I've had a lot of showrunners on the show, and I hear it. I've heard the stories. I hear what they've gone through. And also the one thing we've never even discussed in this episode is the politics. There's an obscene amount of politics that go on behind the scenes of just dealing with the politics of person, like any office. But then when you're talking with studio execs and network execs,
I can give your listeners a tip if you're beginners and you get a first job on the show. And this was told to me by one of my graduates named Yasmin Yilmaz, who got her very first job on her very first show after graduating. And she said she made a policy to be the first one there in the morning and the last one there at night, regardless of what her assignment was. And after a while, the boss noticed that here is somebody who is really giving all she can and never asked for an assignment and then got one because she was helpful in the writer's room. She made other writers look good. It was the generosity of spirit, not competing with them, but making other writers look good, being available to do whatever job there was and being there. And I'm sure she will do very well. And anybody else who's got that attitude, there's an arrogance that you want to set aside. It's not that. It really isn't. I mean, there are people who really should just go, you know, to a private room in the attic and write their movies and produce them independently. And that's the kind of art they do. And that's the life they do. It's nothing to do. That's really very different from actually being in the industry, if you want to pay for your work.
And look, when I first started out, I was driving an hour commute every day to work for free. I worked for free for like 4 months, and I just showed up every day as an intern at this production company until they say, "Hey, you want to work? Hey, you want to do this?" And then my boss quit. My boss quit, and they're like, "Well, who are we going to give this job to? Well, he's been here every day. Let's give it to him."
Yeah.
And I was. Well,
that's life. That's life.
But it was that, you're right, that kind of work ethic is something that is really should be taught in school.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it politics so much as I would call it a sense of participation and cooperation and making good relationships.
And it's all, and that is the one other big tip I've heard from all the hundreds of interviews I've had, it's all about relationships. It's all about building authentic, good relationships. I had a producer on the other day who the craft service intern 20 years later got him a job animating a huge studio movie that went on to make $500 million. And it was they stayed friends all that time. But imagine if they would have never built that relationship, he would have lost out on that job 20 years later.
Well, it's another reason to either go to school or join a workshop, because you hear about openings from your friends.
Yep.
You know, somebody becomes an intern or finds out there's a possible job somewhere. And yes, when you're further along and you have an agent, that's their job to do that for you. But you're not going to probably have that starting out. So, you know, for everybody out there who's just all alone in, you know, Nebraska, wherever, you really got to get yourself to some kind of film school or workshop. You got to get in the mix.
Start building relationships. Yeah.
Probably should be in Los Angeles, but there are some other places too.
For television, like it used to be the case that you had to be in LA for everything. And that, from what I'm understanding now, is not the case anymore. In the feature world, there are things, but television is still very difficult. You need to be here. It helps a lot to be here.
There are writers' rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah, you meet in person with people.
Right.
So you pretty much have to be here. There are a few other places to be. There are some shows that are based in New York.
Vancouver.
Canadian work is another whole issue. A certain number of Canadians have to be on the staff.
Right. Georgia.
Georgia, Atlanta, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, so there are a few other hubs, but basically,
it's okay.
You know, I see the people who do really well, they probably, you know, got an MFA at a film school or were part of some writer's workshop, wrote a lot, didn't write one script and say, there, see, I'm done. Now I'm getting an Emmy.
I'm a rock. Where's my Emmy? Where's my money, guys? You could just back up the truck here. So I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What is the biggest mistake you see young screenwriters make or young writers make?
Let me answer that two ways. I paused because I wanted to think about whether it's about writing the pilot or the industry. Mm-hmm. Let me do a micro first. Mm-hmm. New writers who want to write pilots make certain key mistakes in the pilots. And the first one is to stuff that pilot too much. They say to themselves, oh, I know television is a big ensemble cast. So I'm going to put all 100 of them in the pilot. Yeah, no.
Just like Lost.
Yeah, right, exactly. But Lost, the series, began close on Jack's eyeball. It followed one character right in. And so you need to home in on the quest of a single character in your pilot, right, to draw the story forward and to draw the reader in. So, if there was one single mistake that for pilot writers, that would be the one I've noticed in beginnings students I teach. From the industry point of view, I think misjudging the level that you're going to enter in, that this is a process that's not 1 minute long, then you really want to try to get a fellowship. You want to try to get experience, intern, start on whatever job is there, join organizations, learn your way, put aside that arrogance that you are the one and only most brilliant person, and your first draft is going to make you a star, because you want a substantial portfolio. You want to have written a lot. Believe me, every script you write will be better than the one you wrote before.
Yep, very much so. Now, what are three pilots that every writer should read?
Oddly, some of the best shows are not the best pilots.
Okay.
And so let me just to take a departure to recommend some of the best shows that people should see from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And the top of my list, which is not a good pilot, actually, or not a useful pilot to most people, is The Wire.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Do not imitate the pilot. That's an example of 100 people on screen in the pilot. Don't do that. But if you can look at all 60 hours, you will learn so much about writing depth of character, layered, serialized storytelling. It is truly the great American novel, as it's been called. So you must watch that. You should see all of Breaking Bad. Now, the Breaking Bad pilot is one you should read.
So good.
You know, I have to tell you that the actual pilot as produced doesn't exist. There's an early draft, but it's close enough. Mm-hmm. It's close enough. You could just watch it, actually. Mm-hmm. Just as well. So that's another one, for pilots. Another good sample for learning is Orange is the New Black.
Because
although it's going to spread and have many, many layers of depth in the many characters who we don't even meet in the pilot, it gives you a wedge in through a single character's issue. And it has the example that all pilot writers should know, that opposed to movies, it doesn't close at the end, it opens at the end. And so that's a perfect example of structuring. There are other fine pilots, I'm sure. There are many good pilots out there.
Yeah, that's excellent. Now, where can people find you? Where can people find the new fourth edition of the book and so on?
There are two ways to buy the book, and I plead with everybody to please buy the fourth edition published in 2018. A lot of people have the third edition, but that was 2011, and the world has changed since then.
A little bit.
Yeah. So even if you have the third edition, go get the fourth. And there are two ways to get it. One is Amazon. It's inexpensive, and they will bring it to you in a day. But also my publisher, Michael Wiese, MWP.com. You can buy it direct from the publisher, and they also have some discounts going. Bookstores, unfortunately, don't exist much anymore. You could probably get it at Barnes & Noble or something. If you order it, they would have to go get it for you. But you can get it immediately at either Amazon or MWP.
Mm-hmm. Great. And is there a way to people to reach out to you? Do you have a website?
I have a book website. I don't really use it. So I'll tell you what, I'll give you my email.
Well, we'll put it in the show notes, so don't worry about it.
Okay. All right.
Because if you put your email out, you're going to get inundated.
Yeah. Best way to get to me is through the book, honestly. Mm-hmm. And you'll see. The book also, by the way, has referrals to people who do consulting. Mm-hmm. Not me, other people who do this professionally. And if you can't go to school, go to something. And so there are some other services here.
Pam, it has been a pleasure talking to you and getting deep into the weeds of writing TV dramas. So sure. Thank you so much for the fourth edition of the book. It's been going strong for quite some time.
Yes.
And it's ever changing. And I'm sure the fifth edition will be coming down any minute now.
Oh, no.
Thank you so much, Pam.
You're very welcome, Alex. Nice talking to you. Bye, everybody.
I want to thank Pam for coming on the show and dropping her knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Pamela. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, just head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/115. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave us a good review for the show. It really helps us out with those darn algorithms on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you again so much, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.